sur nous peut s'effondrer et la terre peut bien s'écrouler. Le
Edith Piaf with a hymn to love. The need to sing and perform focuses our show this evening. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is a novel idea. Before Michael Jackson, Madonna, or Lady Gaga experienced their global stardom, the little sparrow, Edith Piaf, was captivating audiences all over the world. Biographer, francophile, and lover of Edith Piaf, Carolyn Burke has just published No Regrets, The Life of Edith Piaf. And you'll hear our conversation in just a minute. Gene Vialli, a white boy from San Francisco, fell in love with black gospel music, and his incredible talent helped define gospel music in America. Rosemary Manchester talks with Gene Vialli about his recent memoir, I Remember Gospel, and I Keep on Singing. And author Barbara Quick shares her review of Yi-Yun Lee's Gold Boy, Emerald Girl. So please stay with us. It's a novel idea. Carolyn, you have a new biography of Edith Piaf out called No Regrets, The Life of Edith Piaf. Prior to that, you have a couple other biographies that are of interest as well. Lee Miller, A Life, and Becoming Modern, The Life of Mina Loy. And these are two people that I wasn't highly familiar with. And I'm wondering what has drawn you to them, Lee Miller maybe being notable to some for her World War II photojournalism, though that's only one aspect of her life and work, and Mina Loy being somebody I wasn't familiar with at all. And so before we launch into talking about Edith Piaf, I'd like you to maybe tell us a little bit about these other books you've written.
Well, I could start by saying that one woman led me to another. I first heard about Mina Loy when I was living in Paris in the 70s, and I was reading all the memoirs by the various expatriates, well-known and less well-known. And in those books, the name Mina Loy kept coming up. She was described as a very remarkable poet and painter, talented in both realms. And I thought, well, who is this and why don't we know about her? So I went to find her poems from the 1920s and was astonished to see that she was a very modern woman. This was in the 70s, as I said. So we had at that time a resurgence of poetry by women along with the feminist movement in that wave. And it seemed to me that Mina Loy was someone who was speaking to us about our own experience as well as about her. So I began researching her life, not realizing that I would end up writing it. In those days, I thought I was studying her poetry. But one thing led to another, and because I was in Paris, I was able to research her life. I found that she was very much involved with the various avant-garde art movements like Dada and Surrealism, which were fascinating in and of themselves. And it was in looking into her Surrealist connections that I found she knew everyone who was anyone, but in particular Man Ray, Gertrude Stein, Marcel Duchamp, and the others. And eventually I met Lee Miller by accident, which is another story, while I was researching Mina Loy's connections to that world, because Lee Miller was also part of that milieu.
And before we talk about maybe their connection with your interest in Edith Piaf, maybe a little bit of your biography. You just mentioned that you were living in Paris, in France, as an expatriate. And what brought you there, and what were you studying there that brought you into this setting?
My time in Paris has been off and on for over 50 years, which tells you something about how long I've been devoted to that place and what it has meant to me. I first went there as a student learning French, which is when I heard Edith Piaf. But I came back to Paris as soon as I could after I'd finished my graduate training and taught in the French universities. So I was actually living there in the 70s. And at that point, stayed for about 5 years. So being an expat, as we call it in Australia, where I was born, I was already keenly interested in the lives of those who had gone to live elsewhere and wanting to understand my own reasons, perhaps by studying theirs.
So you come from an academic perspective, and that does come through in your books with the what seems to be an exhaustive level of research that I'm assuming you have done. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. It must be a fun thing to do, but also a little bit like solving a mystery.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Suzanne. I left academia some 25 years ago because I wanted to branch out, shall we say, and speak to many more people and go out and explore the worlds that my subjects had lived in. I still do the research, as you say, but I've learned to be a very good detective. This is where the mystery part comes in. I'm a tracer of missing persons, you might say, and missing objects and missing ideas, all sorts of things. I think I've learned since my first book about Mina Loy to write for a much more general audience. At least people tell me that, which is very rewarding, because I want to speak to everyone who's interested in the arts and women's lives in those times, in the early part of the 20th century, which resemble our own.
Lee Miller and Mina Loy and now Edith Piaf, who all were living in Paris around the same time.
I know. I thought at one point, because I'm starting to write fiction, and indeed I've been writing a mystery, which just seems to follow, that I could make an imaginary story, or perhaps a play, about the meeting of my three women, and the moment when they were all in Paris and could have met is 1930. But I haven't gone there yet. It is certainly tempting.
Well, you've got all the background material already in place.
Yes.
So maybe just injecting a fictional persona of yourself in there might be a way to go.
That's a good idea.
Because I'm wondering that these three women, Lee Miller, Mina Loy, and now Edith Piaf, all are women who have a certain amount of audacity, a certain amount of courage, a certain amount of darkness as well.
That's absolutely right. I'm very much attracted to the lives of women who had to be daring, who had to have a lot of courage, because their lives were unconventional, to say the least. They followed paths that were not set out for them, that were not set out for women. They had to overcome many hurdles. And I like that kind of story. I find that many other readers do too, that this sort of story is in its own way inspiring. Perhaps I was seeking that as well.
And what brought you then to Edith Piaf?
Well, as I said, I first heard her on the radio when I was a student in Paris at the age of 19, living in a maid's room up 6 flights of stairs. She was my companion, in a sense, and I began singing along with Edith in my efforts to learn good French, because surprisingly, we know she was a street singer. She began in the streets and was incredibly poor. Nonetheless, she learned to enunciate and sing French beautifully. And at one point, one of my teachers at the Sorbonne happened to mention that if we wanted a good example of perfect French enunciation, we should just listen to Edith Piaf. So I was already doing that, and I thought, ah, good. So she was one of my ways into the French language, which I adore to this day. I'm very comfortable and find a great deal of pleasure in speaking French and listening to French in the language itself. And Edith brought me there. Many, many years later, after I'd finished the Lee Miller book, my wonderful editor at Knopf asked me what would I like to do next. And I said that, after some reflection, that I would write another one as long as the person lived in Paris. Which gave me an excuse to go back there to do the research, because you couldn't possibly write about Piaf unless you spent as much time as you could manage over there. And he agreed. He liked the idea of a book on Piaf. So that's how it came about.
And I think that maybe many people's first exposure to the French language may have come, especially maybe during the 50s and when she was coming to America a lot, that may have been their first exposure and affection for the French language as well.
I think so. I was able to research her American tours in a way that hadn't been done before, in part because I'm over here and so I can do it. But the people who have the archives of the Ed Sullivan Show were very generous and allowed me to have copies of all of Edith Piaf's appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show, where many of us first saw her. And that was wonderful, to be able to reimagine what it was like for Americans to first see her, listen to her, feel what she was giving them, even if they didn't understand the language. And a lot of people have told me, oh, yes, yes, we loved her when we saw her on the Ed Sullivan Show, and then we bought her records and so on. She, too, wanted very, very much to be able to speak directly to the American audience. And so she learned English as best she could, and even sang in English some of her classic songs like La Vie en Rose.
And some of those segments from the Ed Sullivan Show are available to view via YouTube.
That's right.
And I'm sure maybe some other venues as well. But he seemed to have some affection for her and was perhaps under the spell of her music.
I think so. They're very funny to watch, because you see this tall, somewhat ungainly Ed Sullivan patting the head of this tiny little chanteuse who is under 5 feet and saying, "This is the finest little singer we've ever had in the United States." He's teasing her and she's teasing him. It's quite delightful.
Carolyn, let's take a short break and listen to Piaf with one of her biggest hits, Mior. You're listening to A Novel Idea. Et prenez bien vos aises, vos peines sur mon cœur, et vos pieds sur une chaise. Je vous connais, Milord, vous ne m'avez jamais vue. Je ne suis qu'une fille du port, une ombre de la rue. Pourtant, je vous ai frôlé quand vous passiez hier. Vous n'étiez pas peu fière, dame. Le ciel vous comblait, votre foulard de soie flottant sur vos épaules. Vous aviez le beau rôle, on aurait dit le roi. Vous marchiez en vainqueur au bras d'une demoiselle. Mon Dieu, qu'elle était belle. J'en ai froid dans le cœur. Allez, venez, Milord, vous asseoir à ma table. Il fait si froid dehors, ici c'est confortable. Laissez-vous faire, Milord, et prenez bien vos aises, vos peines sur mon cœur, et vos pieds sur une chaise. Je vous connais, Milord, vous ne m'avez jamais vu. Je ne suis qu'une fille du port, une ombre de la rue.
I'm Suzanne Lang, here with Carolyn Burke. We're talking about her biography of Edith Piaf, No Regrets. Some of our listeners may have become familiar with Edith Piaf, not only from her music, but from the movie La Vie en Rose.
Yes, the recent one.
And that movie had a certain slant to it that your book did not. Your book seemed to present, I want to say, a more even view of her life. And I wondered what your perspective on that is.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad that you read it that way, Suzanne. That movie, while interesting and full of many good touches and a means to bring her life back to people who might not know about her, was so dark. It emphasizes the tragedy, the suffering. To me, it's a sort of typical format about the life of the star who rises very high and falls very low and suffers and has a downfall and things go from bad to worse, which is not true of Piaf's life. So in my book, I tried to put all of those unhappy periods in context and show her as she was to her dear friends and so many people who knew her, whom I interviewed. That is, a person who loved life, who loved to laugh and giggle, who was a great tease, who had a huge amount of fun, along with going through the inevitable kinds of suffering that she and we, many of us, all go through. So I hope that the book presents a much richer picture. The film, of course, was only an hour and a half, so they had to choose their emphasis. But when I got over the shock of seeing it and feeling depressed by it, I thought, well, that's all right. I'll tell the rest of the story.
So you had already begun your book when that movie was released.
Yes, I had.
Yes.
I was partway into it when the film came out, and I went to see the film with a friend. At the end of it, my friend looked to me and she said, well, shall we jump off the Golden Gate Bridge? It was so depressing. Unfortunately, many people still think that that's what Piaf's life was. So I'm hoping the word will get out through my efforts that, no, she had a hell of a good time. And in fact, she said that she had no regrets. That's why I chose my title.
I felt like I was meeting so many of the people around her that she was intimate with or who she had long-term friendships with. And you had a lot of details on her performances.
Mm-hmm.
And so how did you approach this? And you've already confessed that you approached much of it in Paris. So how did you get into her life and delve into it?
I read all the books about her in French and soon learned which ones were reliable and which were not, because in the case of a great star, there are always going to be a lot of books of different kinds. So I found the ones who were really trustworthy. And in some cases, if they indicated where their sources were, if I found the need to go back and redo the research, I would do that. But I was also very lucky in that just a few years ago, as I began writing, I was given permission to read an enormous cache of letters that Piaf wrote to the man she called her spiritual mentor. These letters had never been used before, and certainly not in English. One man quoted from them a bit in his biography, but I was given Piaf from the inside, so to speak, so that we could hear her own voice, her thoughts. We could see her development from kind of street urchin to thoughtful reader of poetry and even philosophy through her friendship with this man whose name was Jacques Bourgeat. So that was another incredibly precious source that had only recently been made available. And then I was also able to interview a fair number of people who had known her because she died so young. There's still many people around in Paris, and they were very generous. For the most part, they were so cooperative. It turns out that people who love Edith Piaf are glad to meet others who love Edith Piaf. There's a sort of an open-heartedness that she communicated and that I think many of her fans feel. So we're like a bunch of groupies or something. And they helped me very, very much. Eventually, I came to meet two wonderful Piaf collectors. I spent less time in libraries and more time with fans and collectors. These two men who live in Marseille have the largest collection of Piafiana of all sorts, records, films, posters, anything you can imagine.
Any dresses?
And dresses, yes. I have touched Edith Piaf's little black dresses, yes. And they and I became good friends because they saw that what I was trying to do was complementary to what they were trying to do.
Well, I found that her relationship with Jean Cocteau, it intrigued me in a way. And it was threaded throughout the story, but there still was something rather mysterious or intriguing to me, and that they died within maybe days of each other.
Yes, isn't that amazing? I was quite taken by that story, too, when I saw that there was a really close friendship between the two of them, although they were so different. You know, this girl of the streets and Cocteau was called the Prince of Poets, who grew up with every privilege and was sort of at the top of the artistic and social ladder. They really loved each other. He, of course, was gay, so there was not the erotic dimension, which maybe made it a particular kind of friendship that lasted even longer. For example, she asked him to write songs for her, which is so touching because he was a poet and she respected poets. She thought, after all, they write beautiful verse, they could write song lyrics. Well, he didn't do that, but he wrote plays for her. And she performed in one of them quite successfully during the war in Paris. That relationship was very, very close, but I don't think they saw each other all that often after the war, which is perhaps why it remains a little enigmatic. But at the same time, when I was able to read Piaf's letters to Cocteau and his to her, which were marvelous sources, I saw that there was real intimacy there. Even if they didn't see each other so often, they could express their feelings to each other in ways that perhaps weren't possible in other kinds of friendships.
I wondered if it was that they weren't romantically involved and it seemed like there was not a need that she may have had in some of her other relationships. There was a different foundation to that friendship that maybe made it solid that they didn't need to be seeing each other all the time.
Right. I think you're right, because her romantic relationships, of which there were so, so many, had tremendous ups and downs. And you're quite right. The relationship with her mentor, Jacques Bourgeois, was solid because there was no erotic dimension, although who knows, they might have been very, very close, but that was not what was going on between them as far as I know. And then Cocteau and her other men friends with whom she was not romantically involved, but yet very, very close, like her manager, some of her musicians. She was someone who could form close friendships with all sorts of people. And they remained, for the most part, her lifelong allies and part of her family, we can say, her substitute family.
She did seem to always have a lot of people around her, and at least from what I've read in your book, really did have a lot of intimate relationships with men where she not only was involved, I'm assuming, in an intimate sexual relationship, but also often as a professional partner, and she often served as a musical partner and mentor to these people.
That's so interesting. I wasn't aware of that when I got started on this book, but as I went into it, I saw that, just as you said, she mentored a number of musicians, singers, both male and female. Some of the men were her romantic partners, but not all. And she very generously taught them stagecraft, how to choose their repertoire. For example, Yves Montand, that's a very funny story. When she first met him during the war, he was singing cowboy songs in French because the Americans were very popular, naturally, having come in to try to turn the tide. And so she had a good look at him and said to herself, well, this is a very good singer, but his repertoire stinks. So she set about writing songs for him and commissioning songs from others, also teaching him stage presence, a fair number of things about their craft that stood him in such good stead that when he went on his own, he did just fine. She was like that with many people. The generosity of that little woman can't be underestimated. I'd also like to add that she was very talented musically herself, although she was completely untrained. When she finally learned to read music, she began composing with her dear, dear friend, a woman named Marguerite Monod, who was a classically trained pianist who had all the background from the official Academy of Music and so on, but chose to go into popular song because she liked it more. And together they wrote some 30 songs, some of which are among her big hits. So they formed the first two-woman writing team, which is not well known. People rarely have the chance to find out that Piaf wrote many of her own songs, and often with Marguerite Monod.
That was news to me, too. Mm. I didn't realize that she had written so many songs of her own. I'm with Carolyn Burke. We're talking about the life of Edith Piaf, the subject of Carolyn's latest biography, No Regrets. We talk about her during living in Paris during World War II, and not only during World War II, but just her ability to float in these times of political change that she lived through, really, throughout her whole life in France. She didn't seem highly political, yet she was engaged as a musician.
Yes, it's a complex period that. She wasn't political in the sense of joining parties, that's for sure. Yet she had certain political instincts. For example, as soon as the occupation began, the Germans were in charge of all aspects of life, including cultural life. And so there were songs that were verboten. They were on the bad list. And many of those songs had been written by Jewish composers. Now, when it came time for Piaf to do her program, she insisted on singing her favorite songs, for instance, The Accordionist by her friend Michel Emer, even though he and that song were verboten. And at one point, she was called in by the censor in charge of public entertainment who said, look, you can't sing that. You can't sing those songs. If you go on singing these songs, I'll have to cancel your performances. And so she said, well, all right, go ahead. And she, rather than back down, she stayed off the stage for a period of time. Then she did other things that show what kind of person she was. She was making a lot of money by this time, but in her typical fashion, she gave as much away as she could. And some of it she put to very good use to shelter some of these same Jewish friends and several of the composers in the south of France to get them out of the occupied zone and into relative safety, where they would not be picked up by the Germans and sent to Germany. So she did that as well. But what really amazed me, and this is another story that isn't well known at all, when she engaged a secretary who was a very smart cookie who worked for her, Dédé Bigard was her name, she didn't say anything much about her political sympathies or leanings, but Dédé Bigard worked in secret for the resistance, the French Résistance, and was a member of a small unit or cell that was doing everything they could to make use of their connections to oppose the Germans' efforts. Well, when Piaf had to accept a deal whereby she and her musicians went on tour in Germany to sing to the French prisoners of war. This was one of those offers you couldn't refuse. She and Dédé Bigard set up a very daring and dangerous situation whereby Edith had her photo taken with a lot of the prisoners. She and Dédé took the negatives back to Paris, and in the clandestine dark rooms of this resistance cell, the photos were developed in such a way that they were able to make fake identity cards for the prisoners of war, which they then distributed. Think of the danger. know, the SS could walk in at any moment. But they distributed them to the prisoners, and a fair number of them were eventually able to escape. So at the end of the war, Piaf's bravery was recognized, and she was recognized by the purge committee that was looking into the behavior of various entertainers who had had to go to Germany. And they said to her, "Bravo, madame."
That was a bit of information that I thought maybe her approach was just she saw life as something to be experienced and didn't think of it maybe in terms of risk at all, but just in terms, again, of this generosity that seemed to she seemed to abound with, and sometimes to her own detriment in
yes.
a way of having people around her that she was not only supporting, but she was making a lot of money, but seemed to not always have money. And there were people who were probably exploiting her. And
yes, there were people who took advantage of her who were leeches. One of my interviewees actually said that he thought she knew it, that she was no fool, but that in some part of herself she thought, all right, until in a couple of cases it became too much and she had to tell the people that that was that. But she, I think in part it goes back to her having been a girl of the streets, from living for the first 20 years of her life in a way that was so much in the present, where she just had to earn enough to make it from day to day. And when you're in that situation, you share with others. If you've got something, you'll share it with everyone. It seems that perhaps her start in life had certain dimensions that stayed with her for the rest of it.
Well, I wondered, too, if in her early life her mother left, abandoned
yes.
her, and her mother was also a performer, and that her mother then came back into her life, but in a way that was leeching off of Edith.
Yes.
And I just wondered if that maternal bond or lack of bond, that rejection at an early age, formed the rest of her in a way.
I think that must be true. It was such a deep, deep kind of damage to this little girl to be abandoned by her mother, even though she was relatively well looked after under peculiar circumstances, but by her father's family. Nonetheless, she could not forgive her mother, even as an adult, even when she was looking after the mother financially, doing what she could to keep her mother out of dire circumstances. Even so, she could not forgive the mother, nor could she tolerate the woman that the mother had become, because the mother was a drug addict and was a parasite of sorts, and it's just a very unattractive kind of person. It's a very sad story, to say the least.
Whereas she seemed to have a different relationship with her father, who was also a performer, and maybe not a great parent, but she seemed to have a great deal of affection for her father.
Yes, it's amusing to follow that story from the beginning, when he's a street performer and acrobat and contortionist, and she's carrying the hat to pick up the pieces, you know, the money, the coins that passersby will give at the end of his show, to when she's the famous one and she pays for her father to live in better style and buys him beautiful clothes and has a valet to look after him, but he doesn't feel comfortable leading the high life, so he goes back to Belleville, where they all lived when they were just street singers and performers. It's a rather touching story. At least she had that. I'm glad that she and her father, whatever their differences, remained so close.
And she had a child at a young, when she was really
a child
herself, and then that child died. And in the book, the way it's represented is that, well, she was young enough that it almost didn't seem to have that great of an impact on her,
perhaps at the time, but she kept it secret. What I found out when I went to visit those two wonderful Piaf fans in Marseille, whom I mentioned, was that she never or very rarely spoke about her little daughter who died at the age of two. but she kept her picture, a baby picture, in her handbag, and it's only because those two wonderful men allowed me to look into Edith Piaf's handbag that I saw that photo. So the loss was so great that she rarely ever spoke about it, but it remained with her, and she didn't forget that baby girl. It's just that, as you said, she was young enough, I think she was 17 or 18 when the little girl died, that she, and she was in such difficult circumstances, still singing in the streets, that she simply had to find the money to have her buried and move on and go back to earning her keep.
And it seems like Edith Piaf spent her life earning her keep in a way and was driven to perform and really to the very end almost.
Yes.
And I couldn't help but to think of other performers like Judy Garland or even Michael Jackson in
sure.
a way, who
mm-hmm.
are these iconic mm-hmm. cultural figures, mm-hmm. But that burn heavy and bright and maybe burn out.
I think it's even beyond my capacity to imagine what it would be like to be such a person. But I do know that, as many have said, for Edith Piaf, her greatest love, her deepest bond, was with her audience. The public loved her, and she returned that love. And she said at various points when she was terribly ill that she had to go back on stage because if she couldn't sing, she would die. That was her greatest joy. And maybe that's the way it is for people like Judy Garland and Michael Jackson, that having known that extraordinary love, that bond with the audience, they do need to go on until they can't anymore.
Especially when maybe there's nothing else, no other bond or relationship that feels the same fullness,
perhaps.
Connection. I don't know, but it struck me the similarities in these people's lives,
right.
And that at the end of their lives, or certainly what has contributed to the end of their lives, is the weariness, the reliance on drugs to help them alleviate real pain.
Mm.
It's not a fictional pain. Mm. I mean, she was in several car accidents,
yes.
Arthritic, but that really it was a lot of that sort of thing, of easing the pain, trying to sleep, being awake, that really just contributed to their utter demise.
And in those days, taking a variety of different medicines that may not have interacted well with each other, and that in the case of Piaf exhausted her liver, which couldn't process these things anymore. She was a frail little thing to begin with, and she both burnt out and exhausted her system, even though she had the determination of, a giant. She really did die very early at 47 of all these causes.
Non, je ne regrette rien, ni le bien.
I certainly hope that your book, No Regrets, The Life of Edith Piaf, will cause many of our listeners and readers to re-engage with her music. I know in reading the book, it was just wonderful to then go back and listen to some of the songs that you talk about in the book. So I think it's a wonderful gift you've given us.
Thank you. I'm so glad that you went to listen to the songs, that's exactly what I hoped. And as I revised, I listened to all of her music too, because I wanted to feel that I was writing from within the music. May I say something about an opportunity to hear her music? On May 29th, a Tuesday, from 7 to 8:30 in San Francisco at Café La Tosca, opposite the Great City Lights bookshop, I will be reading and speaking about Piaf. And also, you can hear her songs sung by a chanteuse from Paris whose name is Betty Roy. We're doing this program together because we feel that the words and the music are the way to present the spirit of Piaf, whom we both love dearly.
That sounds like a wonderful event and a good way to engage more with you and hear some fine music. And you've just let me know that you'll be back in Sonoma County in the fall for the Sonoma County Book Festival.
Yes, I'm so pleased. I've been asked to come back, and I will.
Carolyn Burke, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Suzanne. A real pleasure.
Mine too.
Influences of black gospel music are virtually everywhere in the wailing, belting song styling so popular today. In the 1960s, Gene Vialli, a white boy from San Francisco, had a Hispanic mother who brought him close to God, and Mahalia Jackson, who inspired him to sing. Here's Rosemary Manchester in conversation with Gene Vialli.
It's a delight to have you in the studio today, Jean. It is such an unusual situation for a person who is not African-American to be called to sing that music. And, of course, that's what makes your story unique. And I like the way that you lead into that. You were, of course, steeped in faith and music at home.
Yes.
And then for your 13th birthday, your family gives you the greatest present in the world. They take you to hear Mahalia Jackson.
They took me up to Nob Hill to hear and see the reigning queen of gospel music.
What a tremendous evening that was for you.
You know, the kids today say mind-blowing. It was mind-blowing.
Yes.
Mahalia, by that time, had embedded herself through her recorded music to the very depths and core of my being. I would listen to Mahalia's albums at home constantly. And so for my mom to say that I was actually going to see her was something unimaginable to me. And then to be driven up to the Masonic Temple on Nob Hill and walk into that majestic building.
Beautiful place.
To the tapping feet of people rushing in to get in on time. And then to sit up in the balcony and feel the spirit of expectancy that was in that auditorium. And then soon after that to see Mildred Falls come to the piano, and behind her, Eddie Robinson to the organ. And they began playing. They were playing music for the entrance of deity. And here came Mahalia, my idol. And then to see her go through one song after another and the electricity that would go through that building, it would bathe the listeners to the point that you would hear weeping at times. This was almost a totally Caucasian audience.
Yes.
Downstairs.
Yes.
I was upstairs with the Latins and the Asians and the African Americans.
Right.
And I don't know if they felt the way I did, but I looked down and saw all these white folks down there weeping and clapping when the songs moved in rhythm and feet tapping. And then I looked around us and saw those of color doing the same thing. You know, that was one of my first lessons as to the effects that truth, she was singing out of her truth.
Yes.
And to see that we were all being caught up by this magnificent, majestic presentation of simple gospel music. It overwhelmed me. I cried through almost the whole thing. And that's a memory that has never left.
Yes.
All these years later, mm-hmm. I remember Mahalia coming to that microphone.
You can still hear her.
I can still hear her. Mm-hmm. And her effect on me to this day is the same.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then, as though anything else wonderful could happen that evening, either your mom or your dad said, let's go across the street to the Fairmount Hotel and have dinner.
My mom was a nightclub entertainer before she was converted.
Oh.
And she had friends who were playing in the Tonga Room. And as we sat beside that big waterway that they have in the Tonga Room, in walked the Queen and her entourage. Well, my mother didn't notice it. I did. And she sat across the water from us. And when I told my mom and my cousin and lady friend of ours who was with us, who was sitting across, they said, well, go get her autograph.
Yes.
Rosemary, to this day, I don't know what I was thinking. But I found myself looking at my mom and saying, not until I can stand on her ground and she'll know who I am.
Huh.
And of course, the table I was sitting at broke up in laughter.
Yes.
When I was 22 years old, Rosemary, I went to hear Mahalia. I was a serviceman then.
Yes.
And she was playing at the Circle Star. And during the second part of her performance, Mahalia asked the people that were working the lights to bring the lights to search down the auditorium until they found the person. She was saying, baby, you stand up, baby. I want to speak to you. I met Mahalia standing at the Circle Star. She was on the stage. Her musicians had seen me come in and recognized me from photos of myself and the Cleveland Singers years before. And we met that night in front of that Circle Star audience. And that's where our friendship began.
Tell me about the Cleveland Singers.
Reverend James Cleveland was known at the time when I was working with him as the crown prince of gospel music. Reverend Cleveland traveled nationally and then internationally. He, at that time, had recorded a song called Peace Be Still, which was considered one of the only 1 million-selling gospel records. He had the largest African-American audience of any other recording artist other than James Brown. I was visiting family members in the Van Nuys area. And this one day in particular, I had been handed over to Andre and Sandra Crouch, who are renowned worldwide for gospel music. They were just young people then, of course, and they were going to babysit me for the day, per se. And we went out for the day, and then they said, we're not going to be able to get you home very early because we have to go pick up somebody. And we'd like you to come with us, and then we'll drop you off after, you know. So sure enough, we went and picked up a person whose records I had been buying. And James Cleveland was one of my favorites. So he got in the car and we took him home.
Imagine.
Well, everybody thought that he had gone out to pick up some food for us because he said he was going in the back to change and everything in his home. And there was a bunch of musicians, like Billy Preston was one of them that was there. And Edna Wright from the Honeycombs was there. I believe that's her group name. And they were all just comparing music and notes about songs. And Andre Crouch asked if I would sing a song. And so I went to the piano and Andre began to play. And lo and behold, out walked Reverend Cleveland. Well, when I got through with the song and was starting to leave with Andre and his sister Sandra, Reverend Cleveland asked if I would consider being one of the James Cleveland singers. Now, I was from a small church in San Francisco. My grandparents pastored there. We were lucky if we had 100 people at that period of time in a service. And here was the King of Gospel, whose average Sunday audience ranged from 5, 10, 20,000 people. I was 17 and a half. I had just graduated from high school. Well, long story short, week later, he asks permission from my parents. Now, you've got to read the book to find out what happens in the interim.
Oh, we don't give anything away in these interviews. No. People will read the book. Don't worry.
And when my parents give permission to go, our first audience, I believe, was a couple of thousand. Our second audience was 10,000. Our largest audience, while I was a Cleveland singer, was 99,000 people. We would travel throughout the summer months, well up into winter, in a car with records under our feet and in the trunk. We had usually 5 or 6 people in the car. There was 3 of us and Reverend Cleveland and a manager. We would sleep in the car. We would eat in the car because we went to every nook and cranny of this country. I know what it's like to sing in front of audiences in grand cathedrals and auditoriums. But I also learned what it was like to go into these little backwater places where buildings were on stilts down south and where singers were called songsters.
Songsters? See? I didn't hear that.
And you'd be greeted at the beginning of a town and they'd say, y'all the songsters that are coming to sing tonight, you know. And they'd tell you where the best place was so you could get something to eat. Remember, this is in the 60s.
Yes, in the South. Yes.
So we could not sleep in the hotels in many cases, in most cases. We could not eat in the restaurants. We could not use the restrooms.
That's right.
Unless you went to the black one or the white one. Mm-hmm. And I was somewhere in between.
Right.
Because being Puerto Rican and Mexican on my mother's side, there is African there.
But you might as well have been white
for, exactly.
for all your audience knew. So you were the white guy in the black.
Yeah, but the only problem with it is in my psyche, I knew better than that.
That's right.
So to use the white bathrooms, I felt like I was forgetting who I really was.
Amazing.
It was quite hard, to say the least. But Reverend Cleveland became the King of Gospel. So I was part of a group that birthed and was part of birthing black gospel as we know it today. We traveled together with the caravans, Shirley Caesar being one of them. I ended up singing at times with Mahalia duets. Can you imagine?
My goodness.
Can you imagine singing with the queen?
I can't imagine.
You know? With the Ward singers, Clara Ward singers, and the Staple singers, and the Mighty Clouds of Joy, and the 5 Blind Boys. These were all people that I saw all the time.
Jean, it's been so good to have you in the studio today. But it's been wonderful to talk with you, Jean, about
your life.
Thank you. The book is I Remember Gospel, and I Keep on Singing, by Minister Jean D. Viale.
And finally, let's hear from Barbara Quick with her review of Yi Yun Lee's Gold Boy, Emerald Girl.
In the 80-page novella that comes at the start of Yun Lee's brilliant book of short stories, Gold Boy, Emerald Girl, a numb and isolated narrator confides to the reader, "It is a terrible thing, even for an indifferent person like me, to see the bleakness lurking in someone else's life." This sentence is emblematic of the spare prose and somehow modest tragedies that characterize these stories, two of which were first published in The New Yorker, all of which are memorable and haunting. Born and raised in Beijing in 1972, Yi-Hun Lee was a self-described math genius who landed quite by accident in the MFA capital of America, the University of Iowa, to pursue a degree in immunology. She aced that and then went on to get two master's degrees simultaneously at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Imagine an American science student going to China at the age of 23 and becoming a master prose stylist in Mandarin. The world hasn't seen anything like this since the 21-year-old Polish-born Joseph Conrad started churning out literary masterpieces in English. The tales in Gold Boy, Emerald Girl are set in the broken landscape of modern China, revealed by Yi-Hun Lee with the acuity of William Trevor's Ireland and England. Like Trevor, whom she acknowledges as her literary master, Lee is a writer whose expressivity comes from extreme restraint. She observes with a scientist's lack of prejudice, with a child's unabashed curiosity, and a cool compassion that gives equal moral weight to the longings of all her characters. It seems significant that Yi-Hun Lee, like so many of the world's literary geniuses, was created in the crucible of exile. I, for one, don't buy the story that the Oakland-based writer hasn't suffered to get to where she is now, winner of a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship and of just about every other honor the literary establishment bestows on our most astonishing young authors. The stories Yi-Hun Lee tells in Gold Boy, Emerald Girl are suffused with a sense of loss and alienation experienced by excruciatingly lonely characters in flight from intimacy. Characters whose suffering, perhaps like that of their author, is too discreet to let itself be known. This is Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Thanks, Barbara, and thanks to all who helped make the show possible today. You can find a playlist of Carolyn Burke's favorite Edith Piaf songs at Spotify, and Jean Vialli's CDs are available via CD Baby. You can listen and subscribe to our podcast at krcb.org. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Rosemary Manchester, and remember, there's no such thing as too many books.